Welcome to the Trombone Retreat, podcast of the Third Coast Trombone Retreat. Today on the podcast, I speak to Jonathan Whitaker, former professor of the University of Alabama and new professor of trombone at the University of Illinois. My name is Sebastian Vera, and I'm joined as always by Nick Schwartz. It's a real podcast episode, Nick.
I know, we've done it. Or you did it, I guess.
Ooh, listen to that jazz voice.
It's pretty stuffy. Pollen is my enemy.
Is that time of year?
Twice a year. This time in fall, I get destroyed by pollen.
Well, I guess it's good that we're not singers. Imagine if like our trombones just like seasonally just started acting weird.
Mine acts weird every day, so.
Well, maybe you need to get it some Valtrex. Is Valtrex?
No, I think it's Valtrex for herpes. I think it might be.
What's the one? See, I'm going to piss people off, but I never really get allergies. What's the one people take?
There's Claritin, there's Zyrtec.
Claritin.
Yeah. Claritin makes me.
Sponsored by Valtrex.
Claritin makes me feel like I'm on drugs in a very bad way.
Don't do drugs, kids. So, Nick, we have some items of note and one special announcement. So, first of all, the 2024 Third Coast Trombone Retreat is happening June 4th through 10th with a deadline of April 1st. Hopefully, I got this podcast episode out early enough so you can actually make your tape. Special guest artists this year include Brian Wendell, new principal trombonist of the Cleveland Orchestra, and Peter Steiner and Constanza Hochfortner, their duo. Visit tromboneretreat.com for all the information you need to know. It's a special experience. This is going to be our 11th?
11 on the nose.
Man. It's a special thing, and we don't post a ton about it. We probably should. Lately in the news, in trombone news the past month, we have former retreat alumni. Well, that's redundant. Retreat alumni, Evan Williams, new assistant principal of the National Symphony. What do you usually call him?
Did I have a name for him?
Yeah, I usually call him just a different whiskey every time.
Oh, that's right, because Evan Williams, I call him Jack Daniels, or I call him Old Granddad, or, you know, just random whiskeys.
And then Alex Mullins, multiple-time trombone retreat participant, just won the Grant Park Symphony Orchestra bass trombone.
Yeah, we're always so proud of our alumnus and their successes, especially when they cross that line into becoming a professional musician where they're making money for their skill set. And that's what we're here for. However you do it, playing the trombone, that's a beautiful thing.
Living the dream. And our special announcement is we will be visiting the International Trombone Festival once again, happening May 29th through June 2nd to do another live podcast. We've had guests in the past of our live podcasts. Let's see if I can remember. The first one was Joe Alessi. The next one was Christian Lindberg. Then last summer was Alan Kaplan and Bill Reichenbach.
Right.
And this coming summer in Fort Worth, Texas, we'll be interviewing Mr. Wycliffe Gordon.
Pew, 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 pew. I wish I had my app for it. My phone's charging in the other room.
Pause for applause. We're currently scheduled for that Friday. I think that's June 1st at 12:30. So it's going to be awesome. Definitely be there for that. On the Patreon, patreon.com/trombone retreat, I recently interviewed Lucas Helzel, who recently won a position in the United States Marine Band. And we just went over his entire process on how he prepared and how he went about winning this audition. It was actually a really cool story. And that's a video podcast that you can check out on the Patreon, as well as every other episode that we've ever done. And lastly, just rolling right through these, Nick.
I love it.
We want to thank our friends at Houghton Horns. So I don't think we've had a podcast episode since our life has been so busy, but I got to basically debut my mouthpieces at the Texas Music Educators Association Conference in San Antonio, Texas in February, which is the biggest music education conference maybe in the world. And yeah, I had no idea what to expect. And the mouthpieces, they sold out in a day and a half.
Like hotcakes.
And it was a pretty special thing, just getting to see the look on people's faces when they tried it the first time and getting to explain the process. And we're just really proud of it. And so there's a few out in the world right now. The next batch is about to be delivered. So we have a few pre-orders in already for those. So if you're interested in trying them, get your pre-order in now at houghtonhorns.com. And also you can learn all about the mouthpieces there. So this talk with John, I got to go be a guest artist down at the University of Alabama. And it was kind of a interesting situation because he had just accepted this new position at the University of Illinois, and we get into that and his reasoning for that. But he had literally just told his students like the day before I got there. So the energy was a little, it was interesting.
I bet. Yeah.
Yeah. So I had an amazing time though. He's an incredible host, like went out of his way, you know, driving me to the airport at like 4 a.m. Just a lot of stuff he didn't have to do. And his students were wonderful. I truly enjoyed it. So you got to listen to it, and I'm really interested to hear your thoughts on the outro of it, but I don't want to give too much away. Do you have any initial thoughts?
I guess my initial thoughts, just to like, as a teaser, I find him to be warm, but structured in as far as his education is, or his teaching is concerned. And I think that that's a wonderful quality. Both those are wonderful qualities for educator. And yeah, I'll leave it there for now.
It was nice venturing down into the land of where you drop the last syllable in every word, going to Alabama.
It's like the A's and apostrophes, you know.
I only gained like 30 pounds while I was there, so in 48 hours, so it wasn't
that's pretty good.
Too dangerous, but yeah.
Well, please enjoy this episode with John Whitaker.
Hi, John Whitaker.
Hi, John Sebastian Vera.
Yeah, you got the full name. That's good. Right. It's important. So, to set the scene here, we are in the Hampton Inn.
The luxurious, spacious, beautiful Hampton Inn.
Honestly, I think so. I mean, in its current state, it looks like a tornado hit, but we're not going to judge that. But it was a very nice accommodation. Thank you very much.
Where is the Hampton Inn that we're currently sitting
in? So we are in Tuscaloosa.
There we go.
And they don't let you forget it. They have the painting on the wall just to remind you, which is nice for someone that travels a lot to wake up like, where am I again?
Know where you are, yeah.
Okay, that's good. Okay, Tuscaloosa. It is my first visit to the University of Alabama. Mm-hmm. I'm honored to be here.
Well, we are equally honored. I mean, it's been a great couple of days. I mean, I feel bad that I've been sort of working you pretty hard, but just really inspiring lessons and great class and recital today. And it's awesome to have you here.
That is very kind of you to say. Yeah. I mean, that's how it is sometimes. You kindly asked me a while ago and we figured out a little niche of a schedule to make it work, and we made it work. And I mean, I'm very tired, but you do it. And and the cool thing is, it's like when you're a student, you've seen so many other guest artists come in and do the same thing. And so it's a model for you. And it's like,
yeah,
okay, if they did it, if they're tired, if they didn't sleep and they taught 8 lessons and gave a recital, hell, I can't.
Yeah.
Too.
And I don't know if you're like this or not, but it seems like I'll schedule one thing and then get calls for 6 others that happen to, you know, bookmark both ends of it. It's like, oh, I can do that, and I can do that, and I can do that. And then you realize that you're just sort of running on adrenaline by the end of these tours or these, you know, these trips, because this, you know, you're on your way somewhere. But anyway, it's always rewarding, and it's always, I love traveling and doing trips like you're on, because you have sort of fresh ears and a new audience and that hasn't heard or seen your thing, you know.
Yeah.
It's always energizing, and you get down to the end of the day, and then you collapse.
It's a fun challenge. And yeah, you hit that wall and it's like, have you ever been traveling for a while and then you go home and your body's like, okay, now I'm going to catch
it
up.
It sort of shuts you down.
And you're done.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
I'm sure I'm going to feel like that after this trip. But anyways, it's an honor to be here. I've gotten to, you know, the original plan was, I've always dreamed of just like seeing what the insane college football experience is at one of the biggest places
ever. We couldn't get that worked out this time.
Which is okay. It was mainly just so my nephew would think I was cool. But just being in this atmosphere is really cool. The music facilities are gorgeous. The vibe of everything, and just seeing the stadium and just being around it, like just as advertised. And
yeah,
quick trip. But so yeah, so we're here. I got to observe you in trombone choir. Mm-hmm. And how long have you been teaching here?
15 years. This is the 15th year. Yeah.
It's It's a long time, John.
I came in 2009, which for the football fans that are, I'm sure there's a lot of football fans that listen to your podcast, but that was the first Saban National Championship at Alabama and first undefeated season in forever, probably.
Is the football team, like, decent here? They're
above average.
Above average.
Yeah. Mark Ingram won the first Heisman Trophy in the school history that year. And I just assumed that it was because of the new trombone professor, you know. And oddly enough, the next year, a good friend of mine, Henry Henniger, who teaches at the University of Oregon, I don't know if your paths have crossed with Henry, great player, great teacher. We were classmates together at Indiana University. And then I think it was the fall of 2010 he got the job, the full-time job at the University of Oregon, and they went to the national championship the next year. And so I thought, well, if the following year was a new trombone professor and a national champion football, we were going to, this was going to be at least an article or something put together about the success of the football program and the trombone studio.
But, I mean, it should definitely be on your resume. I mean,
yeah, I need to maybe edit that a bit, but
I mean, you can't refute it. I mean, look at the record while you're there.
That's right.
No problem. So, man, there's so much to talk about with Alabama. Let's go backwards a little bit.
Yep.
So we grew up in Western Kentucky.
Western Kentucky.
You want to do a brief synopsis of how you came to the trombone?
Really quick. I mean, it was, there was music in the house, but it wasn't trained. Like, I didn't have an opera singer or a concert pianist or whatever, but my dad still does and was an avid guitar player. So we always listened to music or whatever. And I loved my elementary music teacher, who happened to be the middle school band director in the school that I went to. And it was, I just could not wait to sign up for band. I wanted to play the clarinet. And he said, nope, you're tall and have long arms, you're playing the trombone. I said, great.
So you're always pretty tall.
Yeah, yeah. And had a very typical West Kentucky high school band experience. You know, marching band was a big part of it. And you know, all state, all district band, the typical stuff. And I started taking private lessons my sophomore or junior year of high school, probably my junior year of high school, with a man named Ray Conklin, who I ended up studying with undergrad at Murray State. And from Murray State, I got a master's degree at the University of Minnesota with Tom Ashworth. And then there was a year after that I was tapped out. I didn't want to do any more school. So I thought the most logical thing to do would go and teach middle school band.
Whoa.
And it was great. A lot of positive came out of that year for me. But it was, I realized 1st of November it had been several months since I'd actually played my instrument seriously, other than, you know, playing it with one hand and sort of goaltending, you know, and directing traffic with a bunch of middle schoolers in the room. And the other, I got called for a gig and an orchestra that I had played in previously and went and did that. And just, it just, the spark sort of got relit to do what it is I'm doing now. So I auditioned at one school and Indiana University, went to study with D. Stewart. And
man,
I got...
Where in D. Stewart's tenure there was that?
So it was later. I'm guessing that he... I'm trying to remember when he... So he retired and Paul Pollard was his replacement.
DPP.
And so, DPP, that's right. And so Paul has been there. Gosh, you put me on the spot here. No, I can tell you. I can tell you because I was probably halfway through my tenure at Alabama when D retired, Mr. Stewart. It's funny. I mean, he's Mr. Stewart. I would call him coach, actually. And if he listens to this, he'll be
I mean, where you grew up in Kentucky, you don't call your superiors like by their first name.
Nope. And I even Carl Linthe was the same way. He even once told me, he's like, when we're away from school, you should call me Carl. And I said, okay, Mr. Linthe, I'll do that.
Question about that. I've been struggling with that personally. Like, how do you feel? We talked to Ava Ordman about this, and and her philosophy is like, I'm Professor Ordman.
Yeah.
It's important to have some sort of formal boundary.
Yeah.
Like, I can see benefits of both. Maybe the students can connect with you better by calling you by their first name, but also you need them to hold that respect. Like,
so when I first started teaching my first job, I was insistent that they called me Professor Whitaker. And I hadn't actually, I'd left Indiana having finished the coursework, but I had tests and different things that I had to do. But I taught a couple years before I went back and finished the degree formally. But I insisted on them calling me Professor Whitaker or Mr. Whitaker, whatever, because I was really close to some of their age compared to now I'm, you know, I'm getting up there in years comparatively, and there's a bigger gap between me and even my oldest students. Mm-hmm. And so just, and there, and some of my colleagues at the university that I started teaching at sort of recommended, like, you really do want to set up that barrier. Mm. If I introduce myself to someone, my name is John, like, you know, and students, when I travel, can call me whatever. My students typically, you know,
they probably call you all sorts of
things. Yeah. And sometimes not behind my back, but anyway, so did that year of teaching band, 4 years of residency for the doctorate in Indiana. And I didn't go there to get the doctorate. I went there to take lessons from D. Stewart, and I was going to be in the Chicago Symphony as soon as I won the audition. That was sort of how naive.
Because those guys were going to retire.
Yeah,
at that point.
And a lot of respect, but they're still the same section that I'm still waiting on.
Like, oh, they're in their 60s. They're surely going
to
be done.
That's soon. Right. That's right. But then I got closer and closer to the end of that degree and was advancing in some auditions, but then put my name in the hat for a couple college jobs and was getting a look pretty quick. And then I got to thinking about the pros and cons versus, you know, the full-time orchestral life and what I ultimately do now. And I made a run at it and got a gig pretty fast, like pre-doctorate being finished, which is really not that unheard of for 20 years ago. It's a little more unheard of now, maybe. Not unheard of, but typically a first job, they're going to require at least a hard finish date on that degree, you know, for accreditation and other things, so that they want to hire doctorates. Places like the University of Alabama are big flagship places. Don't really care about the doctoral degree if you have experience, you know, perhaps playing in the Pittsburgh Opera and, you know, all the things that you do. They don't really care about the doctorate in our department here, but the smaller schools, it's kind of a big deal.
Did your perception of what this job would be like being a college professor before you started, how different is it in actuality?
Yeah, I thought I was going to have all the time in the world to practice. And in that first job even was before kids. It was my wife and I in our black lab. And I just thought I was going to have all this time to practice. And I was really going to finally put the finishing touches on things in my playing that I really wanted to fix. And what you find is that you're so concerned hourly every day with everyone else's playing, a lot of times more so than yours. And I remember going into it thinking, all right, I'm not going to be one of these college professors that sounds like, no disrespect to any of my colleagues that might be listening, but, you know, there is the, you know, people refer to it as teacher chops or whatever, you know, and I just, you know, it's really hard to teach full time and like sound great all the time.
Yeah.
And I think that's why so many of the people that do what I do for a living plan projects, recital tours, recording projects. We were talking earlier today, this is like my favorite playing that I get to do relatively regularly is concertos, like with bands. I love that because it's a specific amount of time. There's you kind of gauge your, you know, your conditioning and your endurance level based on what you got to do to get through, and you're just sort of up there airing it out. I love that. And I just, you're so focused on the way that everybody else sounds, which you should be, that's your job, that it's easy for things to, you know, your priority levels have to sort of change. And then when you start a family and you have children and they have interests and, you know, it gets tough. And so I just thought, well, yeah, I'm professor of trombone at fill in the blank X. I'm just going to practice all day. And that couldn't be farther from the truth.
There's a certain level of like altruism, like an externalized, you know, we're so hyper-focused on ourselves and being our best version. And then when you're responsible for all these young people and their futures, which are like, you're not like teaching law school where like everyone's going to get a job, you know, you're like, that's a huge responsibility. So all of a sudden it forces you to like really think outside yourself and about the bigger.
And very quickly you think about what is it? I mean, the specific ways you say things, you know, and specific advice you give them. And, you know, it really makes you sort of hang on to kind of like the year that I taught middle school band. It's like these kids, this is probably their favorite class. like their band class. It was when I was in the
sixth grade. I bet you were a fun middle school band
director. It was, you know, the funny thing is the first week I wore a suit every day because I just wanted them to not, I mean, I have a tendency of being a little bit lighthearted and I, you know, it's actually part of my teaching philosophy that I want people to laugh and feel comfortable in a lesson so that it helps get the best out of them. Like, I don't feel like anybody plays really well when they're scared. Mm-hmm. I certainly don't. But yeah, I wore a suit and it was like super structured and super official for the first week, just so they knew that, you know, I new sheriff in town kind of deal. And that went away very quickly. But you really have to be careful of what you tell a sixth grader brass player. Do this, do that, because they're going to go home and do everything you tell them. And if you tell them something wrong, it's like, you know, tighten your lips and blow hard for high notes. Like, yeah. It's like that'd be a disaster, a bunch of high school kids. And it kind of is that way with a bunch of college students too, the ones that are really bought in and are doing exactly everything you tell them. You have to be really careful about how you explain things.
So going back briefly, like talking about the challenge of feeling your best and playing your best when mm-hmm. you're responsible for all these young people in a certain sense. And I imagine there's a lot of, it's a sacrifice on your part, but there's also probably, it's like having a family, right? It's like,
right.
All these other benefits that maybe... Actually, I kind of want to ask about that now.
Yeah.
Were there surprising benefits from having to, like, this whole new level of responsibility?
Yeah, I mean, it's... I feel like I have, and over the years, I feel like I've had a pretty unique personal connection or relationship, some more than others, but could sit down with a list of any of the students that have come through the studio in the last 15 years, and even the 5 years that I taught in Arkansas... and tell you something about them, tell you something about their family, tell you something about their background, what their musical interests were. Most of them, I could tell you what they're doing now, you know,
awesome.
whether being in touch with them or just sort of, you know, social media or whatever. And so that's a real rewarding part of the responsibility of trying to figure out what makes them tick and trying to figure out how they're going to best learn, because they don't all learn the same way.
Yeah.
You know, you can't, there are some that if you sort of even look at sideways, they're just going to lose it. And there's others that you've got to really put your thumb on. They just respond to that type of instruction or motivation. They just sort of need a little nudging, you know. And that's what sort of makes every semester and every year and every class interesting and fun. And it is a big responsibility, you know, because I don't feel like you can teach every kid the same way. And so the fun part, like kind of back to your question, the fun part of that and the responsibility is getting to know everybody individually and then sort of tailoring your approach to how they are as people and what their needs are. You know, not all mm-hmm. of them want to be in the Chicago Symphony, you know, not all of them want to be band directors either. You know, mm-hmm. there's you know, we talked at all these different paths and different interests and, you know, I've got several in my studio that are double majors, like aerospace engineering and computer science and all this stuff, but they want to play well, you know.
So. And that's the argument for, you know, you'd have to say that this level of teaching job is one of the most personal jobs maybe on campus. Because what other class are you not only meeting with the same teacher every semester, but one-on-one every week
for eight semesters or 9 or 10 or however long it
takes. So like you can't keep a distance. Like you have to build some level of trust. And I imagine, yeah, where's the line of like how close you get and, you know, because I mean, the job's like feels like part-time psychologist. Sometimes these kids are going through the most formative times in their lives.
Absolutely. And I think that's part of the responsibility of the job, you know, and one of the first things I do with a new class of people is they come in and I help them get a calendar set up and I help them get their phone. Like I help them get all of the technology because we do, you know, everything. We've got a bunch of different technology things that we use for within the studio, but I sort of make them their one of their first lesson assignments is I want you to put your entire schedule in for the semester. I don't care if you don't think that you're going to remember that you have theory Monday, Wednesday, Friday or whatever class it is, put it in. And I show them if they have never done it. And of course that's getting easier and easier as, you know, generations come through that were born with an iPhone in their hand, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. It's just easier. But set up all your recurring stuff, use color code it, whatever you want to do. And I show them mine and their minds are blown with all the different stuff in my daughter's calendar and my wife's calendar, and you know, and then I have them look for blank spots and fill in those. The first thing you fill in all those blank spots are practice. You know, when are you gonna, and I say get your first session in as early in the morning as you can stand it to get it out of the way, but also do it while your mind is fresh. So you're not thinking about, you know, what professor ticked you off in your 9 a.m. or whatever. Get it done, fill it all in, and work like mad until 5 or 6 o'clock every day. And then and on your horn and everything, so that you don't go home after your last class and you get dinner and you've got all this homework and studying to do and you haven't practiced yet, you know, and just setting that up from the beginning. It's like trying to teach them time management stuff. And then we move on. And then, you know, usually middle of the second semester, you're starting to kind of figure out what makes them tick and why it is they learn the way they learn, you know, and maybe what's happened to them in their past or what they're able to, you know, what they're able to share. But you're right. It's like part-time therapist sometimes. And I can tell sometimes when they walk in the room, and particularly if they walk in the room and their horn's not unpacked, I'll just look at them like, we're not playing today, are we? What's wrong? Sit down. And there's a couch. You saw the couch in my office, and it's, you know, look at this picture and tell me what you see.
Yeah.
but I can just tell when they come in the room. And we'll get through a long discussion, and I'll apologize. Sorry, we didn't play today. No, this is exactly what I wanted. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, okay.
Is there ever like a line where they take advantage of that, or you gotta be careful? Like,
I've sensed that a few times in my career.
I had every strategy.
I had every question. I had every strategy. I think every now and then they know that, you know. And sometimes the big sort of get out of it is, hey, can we play duets? And then I'll be like, no. Can't play duets today. If I suspect, sometimes we can't play duets because I haven't played yet that day. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't do either one of us any good to just pick it up and just slam through it. But
I mean, that shows your wisdom right there. And I'm totally stealing that, because in my young career being a professor, it's always freshmen, sophomores. It's the same main issues of time management.
That's right.
And then if they're not managing time from the beginning, college is overwhelming enough to start. Then they get overwhelmed.
Yeah. It's time management. It's accountability, too, because they don't have anybody chasing them to their next class like in high school. And I always tell them to find a practice buddy. You know, warm up in pairs, warm up in threes. And
that's good.
Because, like, you know, if you make a date or appointment to meet someone at the gym at a certain particular time to go work out or go play racquetball or do whatever, you're more likely to do that because you've made a commitment to your buddy or to your whoever that you're going to meet there. Rather, it's like, I don't feel like going to the gym today. And kind of the same way trying to get younger students, some of the younger students that we get here, you know, you would think at a conservatory it wouldn't be any issue trying to get somebody to, you know, practice. But at a, you know, sometimes at a state school, it's like, just look, you know, set up a time and because you're going to feel really badly that you miss that if you set and the other person came, and then if I find out about it, I'm going to make a joke about it in trauma choir or something. It's like, you know, then everybody's on it. Now they're going on to you, you know. So there's all these little tricks and just things that you learn. And the one thing I have learned in doing this as long as I have is that none of the excuses and tricks that I tried to pull, my teachers, none of them were buying it. And because I just don't, you know, I can see right through that stuff now. Because
I mean, how do you balance it out with, like you said, every student's different, and the instinct, I feel like, for a lot of people, and I remember talking to John Kitzman about this, the instinct when you first start teaching for a lot of people is you teach how you were taught, or you teach how you consume information or how you learn. It's like love languages. It's like you show love how you receive love instead of trying to understand how someone else receives it.
Right.
So, yeah, like, how do you... There's so many scenarios, like, of a talented student who's lazy.
Yeah.
Like, at some point, you can't practice for them.
Yeah. I think the talented student that is lazy, that does sort of the minimal work, I sort of put the carrot out farther to where at some point they're going to come in and they're, I mean, it's not, I'm not purposely trying to break them, but they're going to get to a point to where they can't learn this etude in a week or play this solo or just, you know, play duets with them and sort of put them through the ringer a little bit and be like, well, you know, what's going on? You're a lot better in this. How come you're not able to hang, that kind of thing? And sort of politely try to just grind them down a little bit.
Honestly. But I haven't had time. And then then you show them your schedule. Yeah. And you're like,
The other thing that I like is I played it perfectly in the practice room earlier. And I always like, what is it about the GPS coordinates of my office that makes you terrible? You know, I do believe that there's some of that happens because there may be some anxiety when they come in the room or just like this, okay, I gotta deliver it. But usually by the time they get through their second year and sort of up to the middle of their degree, all of that's sort of worked out and we've figured each other out and worked out the thing. And then it gets fun. You just sort of sit there and you're almost more of a coach than a teacher at that point. It's like, did you mean this? And what are you trying to say musically here? And hey, that's sharp. And you know, that kind of stuff, instead of like really having to get your hands in there to try to, you know, fix every little detail, because they figure it out on their own and how to practice. And then it gets really fun.
When are you having the most fun as a teacher?
The weekends? No, I'm just kidding. I think it is it's like recital prep and those times to where you literally, particularly the when a student will bring a solo or something that they're going to perform for the first time and it's meticulously prepared. And then you just sit there and you question every musical decision they make. What are you trying to say here? Did you mean to slow down there? Did you mean for this? Which is the most important note of this line? Well, that's not the way you played it. And having that kind of dive, that's super fun. You know, and I don't ever try to impose, you know, you've got to play the Tomasi the way that I play the Tomasi musically. I don't. Now, if there's somebody, a younger student that's like, has zero anything coming out in a matter of communication, I'll program in sort of your traditional musical.
Start here.
Yeah, more so symphony, all that, you know, this, and those are great teaching tools because
of Rimsky-Korsakov, your favorite.
No. That's, I have a no Rimsky-Korsakov policy. I need to put like a Stairway to Heaven sign up like at Wayne's World. I just can't do it.
What do you have against arpeggios?
Let's move on. No, nothing.
I think arpeggios is important in B-flat major.
I don't know why that piece drives me nuts. I think part of the reason is that when I was a graduate teaching assistant at Indiana, I taught it like every semester. These non-major.
There's a level of disappointment too, where like we got this very pretty great composer to write a piece, and this is
is all we got. Like, you can't, can we like borrow some from Scheherazade or something and do, you know, it's like, it's, yeah, we, it's don't like,
how, did you write good. This in an afternoon?
Yeah,
I mean, the second movement's all right.
Yeah, it's pretty. I'll give you that.
You know, there's some stuff.
I'll give you that.
Yeah. So Rimsky-Korsakov is your favorite concerto.
Yep.
Please call John and schedule him to play this with your ensemble.
I'm J.S. Vera on Instagram.
Hey, I'll play it. Okay, that's interesting. And man, I could ask you questions about teaching all day, and I probably still will.
Yeah.
And honestly, and we've been talking about it. And so, you know, a lot of these interviews, it's like I walk in and I don't know the person that well, and we kind of just use it to get to know each other. But you and I have been hanging out for like
2 solid days.
48 hours straight.
Yeah.
You're even in there when I'm warming up, you know.
Eavesdropping, trying to learn something.
And so we've had all these awesome conversations, so it's fun to just jump right in and talk about things. But I do want to, you know, what a all-consuming job, because, again, you have to be so selfish. I get to worry about my own playing the majority of the time. I have my students, but it's not like full-time.
Uh-huh.
So you have found ways. You have a family. You have 2 kids, a loving wife.
Yep.
Great dog whose birthday it is today.
Yeah, today's Wrigley's birthday.
Happy birthday, Wrigley.
Wrigley was our pandemic project. We got him the day before the stay-at-home order went in effect in the state of Alabama. And it was great once the pandemic was over, but there were some rough months in there training Golden Doodle
Golden Doodles like exploded with popularity. Yeah. Like everyone was getting, because they're like hypoallergenic. They don't shed.
That's why we got him.
Sweet.
That's why we got him.
And they're like among the top 5 cutest dogs when they're little.
Yeah. And he was supposed to like the we got him from a breeder and picked him specifically, took the kids. And my daughter actually is like that one. Like she picked him.
That's awesome.
Changed his name. I mean, his name was Theo. There was another one named Dexter. I'm like, no, we can't get Dexter because he'll turn into a serial killer. You know, that TV show. But
I was trying to think of like the name of the stadium where like the Cardinals play or something.
Right. But the I lost my train of thought there a second. You're going to have to edit this
Wrigley?
Out.
Wrigley? No, you're fine.
I don't remember.
That's easy. But yeah, you got the, you did the thing and got the dog, and that's awesome. But so,
oh, I remember. The breeder told us that he was going to be 40 pounds, and it's like he's 75.
He's a
like
big boy.
He's massive, yeah.
I've only seen pictures, but
yeah, but he's awesome. He's awesome.
And they're so springy. They're like just...
Yeah, oh yeah, it's like... Yeah. Still got a lot of puppy in him at four still. I mean, he's very, very
any food on the table is gone.
Done. Like, yeah. He is the ultimate counter surfer. So.
So, yeah, you found ways to balance such a consuming job. And it's not like you're at a small school. You're at a big school.
Yeah.
And we haven't gotten to your work with the marching band yet.
Right, right.
But before we talk about that, you've developed some hobbies that have spoken to you. Prolific photographer.
Right.
Like, how did we get into that?
So before that, you used the word balance. And I remember very early in my career, my goal every week was to try to find balance. And I think I haven't figured it out yet. There's not been one semester that I've, like, my schedule, like how I organize my lessons and when I do this, I have not found that, you know. And maybe the last semester that I ever teach, maybe that'll be the one that I sort of strike it, because you have so many different hats that you're wearing, and then you family and kids and hobbies, like you said, and all that anyway. But the photography thing came on kind of by accident in a way. When my wife was pregnant with our oldest, it was sort of around Christmas time, and we were like, what should we do, you know, for the family? Like, what, you know, let's just, you know, instead of giving each other a Christmas gift, and it's like, well, we're going to have this kid this summer, and we'll get a camera. And so I got one and you know, took a few pictures of it, but it was mainly just take pictures of her. And then I have a couple of friends in the profession that are really great photographers, and Anthony Barfield is a good buddy of mine. And I remember we started hanging out, I think, first time in like 2007 doing early Alessi seminars and some other projects that we're involved in, and he'd always had a camera with him.
Oh, really?
And he would always take a picture, and I'd look at him, man, how do you do that? He's like, whatever. So that was a little bit inspiring. And then a good, really good friend of mine, Chris Brannigan, who is in the Pershing Zone Army Band and actually is an incredible photographer and does a lot of media work and public relations for the Army Band or whatever. Wow. He came as a guest artist he conducts the Washington Trombone Ensemble, and he came and conducted the trombone choir. And my jazz trombone ensemble at the university was playing an outdoor event at a cigar bar. And so we
went. Do you like cigars?
I do.
Talk about them.
No. Well, I've only been trying to get you there for a couple of days, but
someone has to be responsible this week.
I know. But anyway, I was taking pictures, and he's like, no. And he basically gave me a little mini lesson right there, that thing. And then I was like, oh, then I got into it. Then I was kind of hooked. And then fast forward to, gosh, I can't remember the year now.
It's 2024.
No, I mean, I'm getting up to, we went on a trip with the marching band at Alabama. My wife and I did to New Orleans to see Alabama play LSU in the national championship. It's the one that LSU's offense didn't make it past 50-yard line, in case your listeners care. And I had to take that camera, that said camera, with me, and was taking pictures and showed couple pictures on the back of the camera to the band director. And he's like, oh man, these are great. We actually need a photographer. Could you do it? Had no idea what I was doing. It's one of those things like,
all the best
I can do it. Yeah. And then all summer, it's like YouTube, it's like, and bought some gear or whatever. And then sort of the rest really is history.
I've been
photographing the band for 10 years. But what I don't make any money to do that. There's several things about that, but I do get credentials and get access to football, and it's just outrageously fun. But I do take some senior portraits and weddings and stuff like that a little bit. But the stuff I really like to take pictures of are outdoors and hiking and the Milky Way and camping and wildlife.
You'll
and
go on stuff. Like photography trips.
We go on trips. And
where's some of the places you've been?
Well, so most recently was Smoky Mountain National Park. It's close to here, about 6 hours. And Chris Brannigan and Chris and Griego and up in Elkhorn, our buddy up there, and some have just went and camped for 2 or 3 days and took pictures, and it, you know, and several. I'll try to get to Colorado every year, just to take pictures of that stuff. And I've got a whole list of places that I'd like to see. But we took a family trip up to the Upper Peninsula, Michigan, one summer.
Yeah.
To try to catch Northern Lights and do some of that stuff.
Did you?
I never seen it. I've never seen it. It's kind of a bucket list kind of
thing. Can we go? Can we do a trip to Iceland?
Yeah, let's go. You book it.
Okay.
And I'll go along.
We'll contact like the trombonist in the Iceland Symphony and set something up.
You know what? I think the bass trombonist in that, if I'm thinking of the right orchestra, might have a Tuscaloosa tie. I might be thinking of the wrong one. David, what's his name? I don't have to look it up later. That's fine. Anyway.
Yeah.
That could be our end right there.
Well, that's the tricky thing because it's like, there's no guarantee of the Northern Lights.
Right.
So you have to take a chance.
Right.
And if you don't get them, you're basically traveling to a place that's dark, like 20 hours a day.
Right.
So if the Northern Lights don't come, you're basically just like, I paid a lot of money to hang out in the dark and cold. Yeah.
You can kind of, you can't really predict it, but when the solar flare happens, you can get it. There's apps and there's emails and stuff, which raises the probability of you might being able to see it. So if you live within 8, 10, 12 hour drive, if you were willing to sort of like, hey, it's Thursday, the thing went off, it's usually 3 or 4 days later, you go up there and there's a chance. But then, you know, if it's cloudy, you're screwed, you know. So I'm going to do it, like one of these days. That's a bucket list thing.
It's been noted, I've like talked about that. Yeah, that would be amazing. I always wondered like what like Native Americans and early people, like when they first saw them, what like they thought what they thought was some sort of spiritual sign or something.
Yeah.
Probably know it is. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So some photography trips. And
yep.
I'm curious. It's, first of all, I mean, it's such a beautiful art form.
Yeah.
And I imagine there's a lot of transference of just the musicality and the skills that you've developed and as a musician that have applied.
Yeah. And it's something creative that's not playing the trombone. That's kind of what is attracted. And it's a little bit techie because there's gear to learn. But there's also, you push the shutter and it works. It goes off. There's no air balls in photography. You know? It's like but you can mess it up. Like you can, mm-hmm. the exposure can be wrong or whatever. But I feel, and I've been on some photography podcasts before, and one of them was specifically talking about the correlations between music and photography.
Really?
And the interesting sort of thread at the end of it was sort of finding your voice, like finding your voice as an artist, as a musician. Also finding your voice as an artist, as a photographer, like how you see light, how you compose, what you do with the file once you get it on the computer, like the post-processing thing is kind of as, in a lot of ways, as creative as the actual art of taking the actual photograph.
Is a lot of it like instinctual as far as like, once you understand how all the tech works, you're kind of just using your eye and following
what feels good. It gets that way, yes. And I have this trick that with myself when I'm in a new room or in a new lighting scenario, I try to pretty much guess what the camera settings are going to be and then take a test shot to see if I guessed it right. Oh, this looks like this ISO and this shutter speed's going to get it, or, and, you know, whatever, and just try.
Do you have one of those like light sensor things?
No, I don't have one of those.
Is that just a movie thing?
No, that's a legit thing. It's just, I never shot film at all. It's all been digital. And now with mirrorless cameras, like what you see through the viewfinder is exactly the way the picture's going to come out. It's cheating in a way.
I just think light is so incredible.
Yeah.
And, like, in my very amateur photography, like, I realize how important light, like, you can try to compose the best photo ever, but if the light is amazing,
yep.
Like, it's, like, hard to take a bad photo.
That's right. And if you're in the most epic spot, and it's midday, and there's no clouds in the sky, that's when you see a lot of black and white imagery.
Yeah.
Because there's a saying, it's like, if you see somebody post a picture in black and white, it means they screwed up the exposure.
Dude, that's, I do that on my Instagram. Anytime it's a great picture.
Okay, filter.
And they always get more likes when they're black and white. Like, they're so artistic.
Yeah,
wow.
Well, I just had to get something out and the photo sucked. But
that's really cool.
It's awesome. And it's just something that we just do. And I've got a lot of friends that are musicians, you know, that like I said, Kristen Griego is getting really into it.
Oh, you're about to get me into it.
And Pat Sheridan is a good friend of mine. He lives in Arizona. So I typically try to take a trip to see him every year. And it's been 2 years ago now, we went out and we had this plan. He calls me the weathermaker because we'd had this plan to go to, like, around Page, Arizona, and southern Utah to catch the Milky Way. And it was March, and so it's low in the sky, so you get these arching panoramas of the Milky Way. And book the trip 6 months in advance. Sure enough, land there, and the whole region is socked in with weather and there's no visibility. There was one gap in the map for like 12 hours and it was Joshua Tree National Park. So we drove to Joshua Tree instead and we camped in his truck and we got some epic stuff. It was really fun. So.
Are you a golfer?
Yep.
I visited Scotland for the first time a couple of summers ago with my family. And I'm just like, first of all, it's one of the most, because I'm sure you visited some of these places and they're just like, I can't describe how beautiful this is. Yeah. You just have to be here. It was right. One of those. And people ask you how it is and you're just like.
Did you go to the old course? Did you go to St. Andrews?
I walked on it. Yeah, you can walk on it.
I'd love to stand on that bridge.
Speaking of, I have a picture. Yeah,
I'd love to go there.
But anyways, it just made me think it would be the best guys trip of like, or, you know, if ladies would like to play golf and drink a lot of scotch.
That's right.
But yeah, a group of guys and you play on these beautiful golf courses, drink amazing whiskey, take photos, go hiking.
Yeah.
We'll just put that next to Iceland.
We'll do it.
And brainstorming.
Once we're over that way, we might as well do both.
Cool. So you found this balance and that's such a beautiful hobby and it's still artistic, it's creative. Like, what do you think the best traits in a hobby are to like feed you?
I think it's distraction from, for me at least, it's distraction from whatever it is that you might be dealing with at work or in your playing if you're going through a struggle or just what it's, you know. And that's the whole thing about balance. If your whole life is nothing but, you know, Long Tones and Ride the Valkyries, I mean, and at some point in your life it has to be that way if you want to really make a run at it. Like, I didn't have any hobbies when I was in school. Like, I was, you know, I mean, I did play golf, but I was on it. Like, I was really, but, you know. For me, it is to keep that balance so that I'm not just walking around all the time thinking about work or thinking about student X's middle register or thinking about, you know, trombone choir rehearsal. They still can't get this one thing in tune or whatever it is. It's, I literally can honestly say, even on most of these trips with musicians, like I can honestly say, I don't think about the trombone or think about teaching or any of it at all for a couple of days. Mm-hmm. And I think that's
what you got to step away.
That's right. I didn't know that. That was not early in my career, like in early teaching here. It was work, and you're trying to get tenure and you're trying to be established and it's like, you know, anymore. It's like, I don't actually really care about that near as much as like, okay, am I able to give my students what they came here for? And if I'm not taking pictures of something or taking a family trip or doing something else other than that every several weeks, then I'm going to be kind of lousy in their lessons. You know? Right. So.
And how do you, when you do get to focus on you and your playing, what are the most, you talked about playing concertos and like you've gotten to play with orchestras all around the country and you have, everyone's friends with John Whittaker.
You know,
you had such a long tenure running the Alessi seminar, which must have been a crazy experience.
It was awesome, and it was really important in my getting started here. It was important for me as a student, having gone to the seminar, and then gotten the opportunity to run the first one that I ran, which I believe it was 2007. And then 2009 was the first one that he offered me a spot on the faculty as well. And we had a great team. We took a lot of care in making sure the experience was just so. But big part of all of those was getting to sit and watch him teach all day. You know, and it's like there's just so much stuff that you sort of picked up on and getting to play and getting to play alongside of him and it just an unbelievable, you know, unbelievable experience. I mean, I think the last time I saw him, no, it's not the last time I saw him, but one of the more recent times was at the ITF in Columbus where I met you and Nick the first time. He'd gotten to ITF a couple days early for rehearsal, and I went over there early to play golf. Like we played golf and just had a ball.
By the way, that's still one of my favorite meetings. Like we're just walking down the street and some guy behind us like, "Hey, trombone retreat."
I listened to you on the lawnmower. I know that's what I said.
Hey, that was one of the best comments I ever heard.
Yeah, I do. I consume a bunch of podcasts on the lawnmower.
But that's a testament to like, and we were talking about this a little bit today. It's like, we're all people and yeah, we do this thing and it's cool and we love it, but it's also what we do all the time. And you're such a connector with people and you're so personable and easy along with and you're a great listener. You've been an incredible host and way generous with your time. We don't have to talk about you driving me to the airport at 4 a.m. tomorrow.
I think there's something I needed to tell you about.
So your taxi will be here.
Yeah, that's right. Your show.
But there's something to getting to know people. It's about relationship building and not right. about...
I mean, the trombone is sort of the starting, is the jumping off place, you know, obviously. But, I mean, I would way rather play in a section or chamber music or whatever with people that I know and that the vibe is really good. Because then you don't really have to worry about, you don't have to worry about any dynamics. You don't have to worry about it sounding good. You don't have to worry about hurting anybody's feelings. You know, it's like, hey, you know, I think this is sharper. This is this or this. I mean, it's just like, okay, great. You're sort of coming at it all from the same, you know, from the same thing.
You want to hang out with your friends.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So.
Back to a couple, if I may ask some more teaching questions, just to pick your big teacher brain.
Yeah.
Teaching. So now at the collegiate level, 20 years,
mm-hmm.
how has the student mentality, the average student mentality changed over time? Have you seen?
Students are unbelievably distracted now, more so than they were even 10 years ago, really. And they are a general statement. A lot of them are looking for a quick fix. And some of them are looking, and that's not just in my studio, but this, and I'm not speaking of anyone in particular, but also I've talked to a lot of other professors about this topic, and I don't think I'm the only one that feels this way, is that they're looking for a quick fix, and they're often looking for it elsewhere, not what happens in whatever studio, and, you know, just buy in and commit and sort of do the work. Now, there are people in every class or every I'm doing air quotes on a podcast, I'm not sure why, but every generation of studio, so every cycle of students, right, there's always two or three that just do it, you know, and they just, and I, you know, you've heard a couple of them today, and, mm-hmm. and I've had several throughout my life that are, in my career, that are just, they do what you tell them, exactly the way they tell them, and when you speak to them in a lesson and you ask them to change something, their response is, okay,
mm-hmm.
instead of, well... You know, Sebastian Vera said on his blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah. you know, and it's, and I don't really take offense to them being excited about information. I mean, I'm in the job of trying to, like, for example, if a guest artist comes in and says something and it clicks with a student, then I've done my job. I may not have been responsible for that thing clicking, but I was mm-hmm. responsible for bringing the guest in and providing them with that experience.
And sometimes, you know, I'm literally saying the exact same thing. Well, yeah. I know you've said a million times.
Someone out of town with a CD and a website is a expert, and I'm the guy that's here all the time. You know,
so, or sometimes it's just like hearing it.
Right, from exactly.
a secondary exactly. source, like, oh, maybe my teacher's not crazy.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And so I think they're really, really distracted, and I think they're really... We'll figure out something in someone's sound or someone's technique or articulation. And I said, now, you know, this might take you 6 months for it to be default. You can't go into the system preferences and click a checkbox and then it's fixed, you know, you come back the next week and it's probably not going to be any better. You know, mm-hmm. these are long, sometimes these are long, you know, long things to fix, you know. And some students just can't, they just don't like that. They just can't.
I mean, this is old school trial and error,
yeah.
blue collar, like, hey, we're going to do 0.25% gain every day.
Yeah.
I mean, every now and then there's something that you can fix pretty quickly.
That's right.
That's always great in a master class. Like,
yep.
you have some tricks with
yeah,
like,
everybody got to have a handful of those tools that make somebody immediately better. And every good teacher has that, you know.
But yeah. But at the same time, it's like, in a way, we have to be empathetic because it's like all they've ever known is things working very quickly.
That's right. And connected to their devices all the time and information overload all the time. You know,
and that's why they don't listen to anything.
You know, the interesting thing, I was in my tuba colleague at Alabama. I was in his office a week ago just talking about something. I went to look on the door and he's got something hanging on the doorknob that I never noticed. I'm like, what's that? He says, that's where their phone goes when they come in this room.
Whoa.
And I was like, okay, I'm on it.
Love
like,
that.
I'm going to figure that out. And we'll go through periods of time where I'll make people leave their phones in their trombone case during trombone choir, just so that when they're not, mm-hmm. when they're resting, they're not scrolling, they're just paying attention. I haven't had really any issue with that as of late.
I always say, like, the best hack for the best, the simplest, like, app, technically not an app, but, like, for productivity in the practice room is airplane mode.
Yeah, exactly.
You can use your metronome and tuner still.
Well, and the other thing about all this, too, is that they, with social media and the internet, and everybody really feels connected to all these superstars and these heroes, and they see all these really well-established people putting out content and making practice videos and making this or that or whatever, you know. But the people that I'm thinking of didn't really have any of that stuff. I mean, they've accomplished a great deal, and a lot of them are able to put out this stuff. What you don't see behind the 100-day practice challenge and all these things is the years of solitude in a room with no technology. And like our heroes, and we probably share some common heroes. You know, we talked about Joe earlier. He didn't have Facebook when he was 18. You know, he practiced a lot. I'm guessing. I know he did. But, John Kitzman didn't have, have to check his Snapchat or whatever, you know. And I really think...
That's a great... I'm trying to imagine that image right now.
You're trying to imagine Mr. Kitzman on Snapchat. Yeah. But I think it's a... I think in so many ways, it is... It's made them impatient. It's also made them... not able to... Discernment is not a skill that a lot of young musicians have. They can't... They, for themselves, can't discern quality levels from recording to recording to recording. It's what's the easiest access, you know? Hey, did you listen to recording of such and such? Yeah, I got one. Great. One, that's... Okay, that's a start. Who was it? I don't know. Where'd you find it? YouTube. Like the first thing that popped up, you know, it's like, you know, it's, and
I heard the one recording.
Yeah. The recording of Mahler 5. There's just one and it's on YouTube, you know, or whatever. So I'm fighting those battles all the time and I'm pithy about it. Like I kind of rib them about it. You know, I'm going to be 50 this summer. So I don't know if 50 is when you can officially like play the old man card or the old, you know, the old teacher card, but I'm playing it right now, you know, because I mean, I'm twice the age of these people.
Yeah.
You know,
and there's gotta be, it's like with every technological advancement, there's a lot of things that are negative, but there are a lot of things that are positive. So can we somehow use this to a positive?
Yeah.
Yeah. They're more connected, I guess.
Yeah.
You're more exposed, but I guess there's more quantity over quality.
Yeah.
I do see sometimes that, especially if they're only listening to recordings and not going to live performances, there's a perfectionism thing involved where they think it should always be perfect and never miss a note.
All of those recordings are lies, you know, and I mean, some more than others, but there's always, the perfectionism thing. That's a great point. And, you know, the other thing that I liked your airplane mode thing, but I have a thing that I do at master classes a lot about their phone. And if people have legitimate social media addiction or just addiction to their technology, I tell everybody to make a folder and put all of the apps that, whatever they are, you know, Snapchat, TikTok, whatever, Twitter, X, whatever it is, put it in a folder. Title the folder in bold letters, Go Practice.
Wow.
Then on the phone, make as many pages as you have to scroll and put it on the last page. And then before you turn your phone off, get in the habit of resetting it to where it goes to the home screen. So then if you're in the practice room and you pick this up and you make several conscious decisions to turn it on, to scroll over, to read the words Go Practice, and then click on TikTok, then it's like, okay, that's a habit that you sort of have to break. And I've heard from dozens of people that's like, yeah, I did that for 6 weeks and it really helped. And now I just don't pick it up in the practice room anymore. So I don't know.
What are you most proud of during your career so far?
The successes that each individual have. And that doesn't necessarily mean winning an audition or whatever. And sometimes people, you know, sometimes people get midway through their degree and they realize that they would rather be X than a trombone player. And I love that because they figured out what they want to do, you know. But just hearing about their individual successes, whether they, you know, win an audition, or they get a college job of their own and have students of their own, or, you know, start a family, or, you know, whatever. I mean, it's that really is the thing that I'm sort of the most proud of. And maybe secondary is the culture that we have established. It's, you know, I have a teaching philosophy that I've said hundreds of times at different places is, and it's simple. It's offer the best experience possible. Now, I always qualify that by saying, I'm not saying it's the best collegiate trombone experience in the country. I'm not saying that. It's also, but it is the best experience that I know how to do based on my experiences and my teachings and the resources that I have at the institution. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that's just so. Guest artists, you know, trombone choir, a vital part of what we do. Studio hangs, you know, chamber music, section coaching, all of the stuff, you know. I'm pretty proud of sort of the mark that that has made.
You should be.
You know, on the people that have come through that. And I think pretty much without fail, everybody would tell you that has been through it, that they had a good experience. I hope so. Like, I really hope that there's not this whole, like, you know, group of people that study with me. They're just like, oh, it was just awful. I hope not. You know, the experience, you know, mm-hmm. I might be feeding them a line of garbage when it comes to fixing their whatever, but mm-hmm. they had a great time.
At the end of the day, it's a family.
That's right.
It really feels like it. Just even being here for 48 hours.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
that's a
It's a good bunch, and it's, you know.
How do you go about, like, building trust? Is it just...
I try to get to know them as soon as possible, and we've talked about this a couple times driving around, and I try to make them laugh as quickly as I can.
Huh.
So that they feel comfortable coming in the room to sort of be vulnerable and play something that they're maybe not good at, you know. And so if I know something about them, and the lesson usually starts with, you know, how's your boyfriend, how's your girlfriend, how's your this, how's your that, you know, how's this professor that you hate treating you, like, mm-hmm, you know, just know sort of what makes them tick, you know, mm-hmm. and you start to accumulate that as they go through the program a little bit, you know. Then when it's time to sort of, all right, let's fix your mental register or whatever it is, then we're sort of, they, I think, have a feeling that we're sort of going at the thing together.
Yeah.
And we're after the same thing, but I'm not, it's not this, we have to do it this way or you're never going to, you know, it's like, all right, let's figure this out.
Defenses
you know?
Are down.
That's right.
And it's probably something when they realize that you care about them.
I hope so. Yeah, I really do. And I think most of them feel comfortable. I mean, they talk to me about things that are completely not related, you know, and mm-hmm. that makes me feel good too, that they trust, like, hey, can I talk to you about something? I've got something going on I need some mm-hmm. help with. What, I need your advice, or I just need to get this off my chest or whatever.
So 15 years.
Yep.
Been at the University of Alabama.
Yep.
And something that we've been talking about and is, you know, will be breaking news probably by the time this podcast comes out, and you can talk as much or as little as you would like to mm-hmm. about this, and you have a new position.
I have a new appointment pending, and by the time this is released, it will not be pending. I've been offered a professorship at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. Yep, there's one person clapping.
Just like my recital tonight.
That's what, yeah, they were all clapping. There was only one person there, but they were all clapping. No, and I'm super excited. I just think that the opportunities there are no boundaries on what might be possible there, but between the other faculty and the facilities and the resources and the sort of the culture of the school and the history of the school as a total school. I'm just super excited to sort of get started and kind of build a destination to where it's, you know, it's on the list of places that people look.
I have no doubt.
I'm very hopeful.
Why though?
I just kind of felt like it was the right time. There's been several years. Like, so when I first got here, there were a couple of jobs that I sort of put my hat in the ringer for and was way too early, you know. Like Eastman, this, all these places, it's like, eh. But I saw opportunity for professional and personal growth for me in different ways there than I have here because of the resources that they have at the school versus the resources we have at our school. at Alabama at the moment, and funding and collaborative piano and just a bunch of things that I don't know, I just saw potential to be able to sort of do more and do more for myself, but more importantly, do more for another crop of students. And if, you know, when I'm able to talk about this with people and then hopefully students look at the program. I don't know what the roll slide hook is going to be yet. I don't know what the hashtag will be. It's way cart before the horse.
Can't start lessons until you have your hashtag.
I can't even, they probably won't even let me buy a house until I have the website bought, but I'm hoping that what they do is that they can look at the 15-year record of what we've done here, both on the website and our YouTube channel and social medias or whatever. And it's literally the culture and the everything. It's all going to be transplanted to there. There probably won't be as many Southern accents, and the barbecue won't likely be as good, but
closer to the Cubs.
It's exactly closer to the Cubs. So, and having the Krannert Center of Performing Arts right there, and you know, Chicago Symphony, Schulte used to record there. Chicago Symphony plays there very regularly. Lots of really important musical acts come through town. And it's just right across the street. I mean, that's one of the things I'm really excited about, is having sort of an arts, little bit more of an arts sort of thing happening, to be able to go and listen to new music or go see a ballet or go listen to the, you know, the whatever, you know.
It's such a cool location. We were looking at the map the other day because you have Indy, St. Louis, Chicago, so many great orchestras.
And I also have family history with that school, and I have cousins that live in town. They don't know about the job yet, but they will by the time everybody knows. But my grandparents are buried half an hour from there.
Wow.
Both sets of grandparents are married from there, are buried there. My parents grew up in the area. I was born close to there. It's a couple hours closer to home from there to where my mother and my brother live, and where Amy's, my wife's family is right there. It's close. It's a little bit of a quick, it makes it a little bit more of a quick, hey, let's go down for a day, rather than we need to plan a trip. I'm a huge Chicago sports nut, so like that's how I sold my son. It's like, hey dude, they're 2 o'clock game at Wrigley Field, we can eat breakfast at our house, drive, catch the game, be at home before bed, don't have to get a hotel, just like, and we'll do it, like that's gonna be awesome.
I mean 15 years in any place is a long time. I mean, for any job, I mean, just the change of scenery alone is exciting. I'm excited for you. But I can't imagine this was an easy decision.
Not at all. And it's students and colleagues and just, you know, we kind of made a life here a little bit. Like, our son was born here. Ainsley was, my daughter was one when we moved here. I think her pitching coach might be the person that is the most upset. It's like, she was one. I actually called her the other morning on the way to get you to the airport, because she was one of the people that I hadn't told. Because now, at the time of this recording, my students know. And my colleagues know. They don't know where, but they know that something's coming.
How was that experience?
It was tough. I mean, the first 10 minutes was rough. Like, I had to sort of stop. Like, tears didn't come out, but I was choking it back, and they could tell. And then I sort of ripped the Band-Aid off and told them, and there was sort of this awkward, you know, what felt like minutes, but just a few seconds. And then I just told them, you know, I told them several things. I said, one of the things I said is that if you all took out a pen and paper right now and wrote down 10 things that you thought were why I was doing this, you'd get 7 of them. They probably would, you know, because they're paying attention. They're smart, and I'm in the most professional way possible. I'm not very guarded with them about stuff, you know. And they ask questions that sort of trigger, you know. They get it, okay. The other thing I told them is that there's not a person in this room that wouldn't do the same thing if you had the opportunity. Because of a lot of, you know, because of the terms of my appointment and contract and just things that they're very eager and armed to build to help me build a really special thing. And then 20 minutes in, I let them ask some questions and stuff. And then we were right back to laughing and cutting up and making fun of, you know, the 2 or 3 punching bags in the room. It was great.
There's always a couple of punching bags.
That's right.
But there's no perfect time.
No.
It's not like, all of your students will graduate at the same time and you don't have to do anything.
There really isn't. You know, we're starting to have conversations with each of them individually about, you know, I let them get it off their chest and then I give them advice and I tell them, I'm going to give you advice that I would give you if I were your parent. If you were my child, what I think you should do, you know, and somebody that's right at the tail end of their, you know, there's no reason for you to get in the transfer portal, you know. So
wouldn't that be nice if all you had to do is upload some recordings and
I'm available.
Calls you.
Yeah, you need a
full scholarship.
You need a solid third partner quartet citizen. You know, you need a good defensive lineman. What we got your player, you know,
and they'll like they'll just like. To secretly give you some cars and
I would love some NIL. The NIL that doesn't come in the trombone studio at all. But it's been you know there are people and colleagues and experiences that I'll miss. And when
what
people
do you miss the most,
probably some colleagues. You know that'll be tough. And when people find out about this, when this actually. I mean, people already sort of know it's kind of starting to make its way through, you know. But when the general, like, everybody knows, there's going to be a lot of head scratching, you mm-hmm. know, because it's like they see my posts on my personal accounts about, you know, standing on the sideline in Alabama football and taking all these trips and working with this, what I think is one of the best, if not the best, college marching band in the country and all this. Like, how in the world would you give up this, you know, but, you know. As we know, nobody's sort of airing their dirty laundry on their social media. Sure. So it's
there's just, no microphone here. I mean, you could say everything.
Yeah, well,
no one's listening.
Look at the time. But it'll be the, you know, the colleagues and sort of the relationships that I've built with a handful of them. But mm-hmm. you know,
and like we were talking about, there's I don't know if you're aware since you've always been here, but there's a fairly sizable. Fan base for Alabama outside of Tuscaloosa.
I understand that the football games are televised.
I'm pretty sure you'll be able to watch.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unless they just, but based on your record, based on the team only being good while you're here, if you leave,
we're going to see what happens next year.
I mean, I don't think it has anything to do with Saban.
Alabama in the last 15 years, and I've kept track of this, 188-21 and 6 national championships. That's, you know, so if next year they lose 6 games and Illinois makes it to the Rose Bowl for the first time in 20 years, you know, build a statue.
By the way, like, just quickly, like how I would love to see that statue. I'm imagining what pose you'd be in.
Yeah. But like, I would have the ring of confidence on my chops, and I'm for sure, like it would look like I just played a high F for 20 minutes.
Just briefly, like how hard is it to be in, like, the coach you hired is like an incredible coach,
right?
But like, how hard is it to be replacing this Nick Saban, and like, how little a leash will you get if you lose like 4 games?
Well, I'm gonna go on the defensive for the new coach here and look. If you look at our schedule, I mean, Saban could have lost 3 games next season. I think it's the second or third game we're at Wisconsin, which historically they've got a strong. Whatever, it shouldn't be any issue. Then the next game, Georgia comes here. That and there won't be any bigger game in college football than that next season. Fight me. There won't be. And we have to play at Tennessee, which a couple years ago they sort of broke their. There were people that, like, there were teenagers that had never seen Tennessee beat Alabama in football. It was funny. Then we last second, it was, and I was there. It was brutal. Mm. At Tennessee, at LSU. At Oklahoma, which is now Oklahoma and Texas are in the SEC now, and there's so this sort of it's brutal, you know, the schedule is brutal, and I say if he gets 4-0, beats Georgia, and beats Auburn at the end of the season, it doesn't matter what happens in the middle, that he's gonna fan base wise he's gonna be fine. Now with the new, you know, we got another hour to talk about this, but that with the new playoff format. 12 teams, there's no way they're not going to be in the playoffs.
Sure, sure.
It's just like, yeah. So it's just a bad. It's
because it's all rigged anyway. So
it's all rigged. It's, you know, Paul Feinbaum basically picks the 4 teams and then, you know.
For someone that gets to experience this rare phenomenon of, you know, for a listener in Australia right now, when we're talking about college football, if that wasn't clear, which is, you know, of the major sports, it's like, it's the number one college sport as far as, I mean, March Madness can get a lot of attention, but to describe what the energy is like and what it feels like being on a sideline, you get to go on the sideline all the time, taking photos, you get to work with the marching band, the energy, I mean, can you even describe?
And it's unbelievable, and it never gets old. Week after week, you walk through the tunnel onto the field before the game's even started, and it's like walking in the Colosseum in Rome. You know, it's just like this.
How many people?
103,000.
103,000.
Yeah, yeah. All sober.
Yeah.
It's like anything, and then being in the stadium in a particularly a night game. Against a rival, you know, LSU or a Tennessee or whatever.
I'm so mad I didn't get to go.
Wait, you know what? We can still go. They're not, contrary to what people might think, since Saban retired, they're not shutting down the athletic department. Like, okay. There will still be games.
It all into the music department now?
I haven't read that memo yet, but there's ways to get, we'll get you in a game. But it is pretty unbelievable. And if you follow the sport at all, I was, you know, 25 yards from where Tua threw that pass to Devontae Smith in the national championship. Wow. Second 26. You know, the number of games
and just game.
Amazing. I was at the Auburn kick six game.
Ouch.
And it's brutal. I hate going there. I'm just going to say that for the record, for all your listeners, it's a miserable. I hate going there. I just hate it.
So many memories.
And because it's like, it's just like freaky. Freaky things happen. We beat them by 3-4 touchdowns every year in Tuscaloosa. It's always a one-score game down there. Doesn't matter how good
the team is. That's why you love rivalries, because it doesn't matter if your rival is 3-10 that season.
Right.
That it'll be because they know you.
Right.
And their whole season is worth it if they just beat you that one time.
Yeah.
But we could talk about Alabama football forever. Yep. And I imagine it's just like
one of my favorite subjects.
It's got to be such an adrenaline rush. I mean, do you have a crash after games? Like,
yeah, I have a routine after games, actually. Regardless of what time the routine is or what time the game is over, I go home. I put the memory cards from the camera in the computer, and I start just sucking down all of the files. I go and change clothes out of the stuff that I've been wearing all day. I get a cigar. I go on the back porch, and I try to find 10 images that are social media worthy and edit them and send them. I used to do the social media for the band too. So I would have, I just made it a point I wanted to post before I went to bed. And now we have someone great that does that. And then I just sort of feed pictures.
Give it to them.
And so I just like to get a handful of them edited and whatever. And so it's the decompress is watch whatever, you know, lame West Coast game is on late at night. Teasing. But watch the late football game, have a cigar, put my feet up, just
you
gotta
bounce it out.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, because literally the chemicals happening after that sort of adrenaline, it's like, it's equivalent to like being at a rock concert.
Yeah, it's nuts.
I mean, they even talk about, I mean, musicians, there was those studies of even classical musicians can experience the same chemical release of euphoria, and you're feeling it late at night. And that's why so many musicians need to go to the bar and have a drink, and why there's drug issues in all music is because you have this high and you got to.
You also feel it on the flip side too after a rare loss. It's just like you just feel like you've just been kicked in the gut.
Why do I like this game?
Yeah, it's like
I'm a Dallas Cowboys fan. So
you don't like the playoffs?
No, there's something way worse about being sold high expectations every year. And constantly being laid down. I would much rather have a team that just is
so
terrible.
How is it being a Cowboys fan and living in Pittsburgh? But do you follow Steelers?
You know, to anyone in Pittsburgh over the age of like 45, they hate the Cowboys. I mention it.
That was a right. That's like
they remember Super Bowl losses.
Yeah, I remember those games.
Most
as a
people
kid.
Under a certain age don't care.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, like when I lived in New York City, most people are not from New York City, so you like whoever at the bar.
Doesn't
if you go
matter.
To Philly, you better like Philly teams. Like,
but if you put on some Bama swag and take a run through Central Park, you're going to get five or six Roll Tides. It's happened.
I love
like
that.
It's like every anyway. Sorry.
I love that.
Yep.
Roll Slide. We barely even talked about.
That's right.
The best hashtag ever. Roll Slide. Okay, I think it's a good time for some rapid fire questions.
Here we go. I'm a long time listener, so I'm anxious to see.
Which I very much appreciate, by the way.
Anxious to see what we're going to get here.
Well, you know the first question, advice to your 18-year-old self?
I would say make it a habit to take care of yourself physically and psychologically, mainly physically. Make it a habit when you're young. Establish a habit of taking care of your body, exercising, you know. And my weight has fluctuated quite a bit, and I'm sort of trying to get it back to back down to a reasonable thing. But
you should walk to Illinois. That'll do
that. Yeah, daily. But make it a habit to sort of take care of yourself. And yeah, that's what I would tell myself.
Good answer. Well, this will be a good one. I mean, favorite recording that you've been a part of?
That I've been on?
Mm-hmm. You just played an incredible one that people need to hear.
It was probably recording Anthony Barfield's soliloquy. I was in a trombone quartet for a long time called Stentorian Consort, and the recordings are still out there on the streaming stuff. I'm incredibly proud of them. It was a great group. But we commissioned Anthony to write this piece called Soliloquy for Solo Trombone and Trombone Quartet with Joe Alessi as a soloist and sitting next to him in a recording session. And he's playing the solo part and I'm playing lead in the quartet. And so we have a lot of this stuff paired together or whatever. And it was so intense and it was incredibly rewarding to be able to sit next to your hero and try to keep up. Try.
And I just want to say, you just played a recording of you soloing on the Mackie.
Yeah, Hymn to a Blue Hour.
And
yeah,
that's absolutely gorgeous. And
yeah, thanks.
Can people hear
that? Yeah, it's on Spotify, Apple Music. It's on one of my discs. And I'm the most proud of that track in particular because the background were students of mine at the time, undergrads and a couple grad students. And I'm as proud or more proud of the way they sound than, you know, anything that I did on it, but it was fun.
I seriously recommend listening to that. It was absolutely gorgeous and so well recorded and so beautifully played. And
thanks.
It was, I got to listen to it right before we did this. So that was really cool. Let's see. Oh man, there's a lot of good ones. I just jot down a lot of these. What do you think your younger self, it's almost the reverse question of the 18-year-old. What do you think your younger self would think of the life you've created today?
I think they'd be excited. I think I'm kind of doing what I always thought that I wanted to do. Meaning that I wanted to be doing music, right? For the longest time, I wanted to be a band director and do the thing, but that wore off pretty quickly. But the fact that I'm teaching at a flagship institution, I have all these students, I have all this really cool stuff that I've gotten to do, I think they'd be pretty stoked.
What advice would you give to a person starting out on a path that you've been on, like wanting to do a university teaching position?
Yeah, I mean, it requires some school, you know, and we talked about that earlier in terms of the degrees and all that sort of stuff. I think you've got to play just as well to get one of these college teaching jobs as you do to get a playing job anymore. I mean, because there's so many, I think there's a lot of people looking at the life and the career that an applied music teacher has, the flexibility, the artistic outlets, you're not really locked into playing what they tell you to play, when they tell you to play it, how they tell you to play it. And I'm not making light of an orchestral career. I mean, I would love that, you know, that was always the dream, but you've got to play incredibly well. And you really need to have other skills that market you. You know, you got to be strong. I think you need to be strong in other areas, be able to conduct, be able to coach chamber music, be able to, you know, teach theory, teach this, teach that. I mean, I think it's going to become more and more necessary for those things to happen, you know. And your master's degree is incredibly important because I think that degree is a practice degree. Mm. It's usually academically is the less rigorous of the three traditional degrees. And you need to go study with a teacher that's going to just put you, really get your playing in shape. Yeah. Your doctorate, you need to study with someone that is placing people in the job market, you know. And there's a lot of people that are doing it, and that's, you know, And that's by and large, that's the only reason to get a doctorate, really, is if you want to be a full-time collegiate, if you want to get in that, break into that door. So
you have,
sorry, that wasn't very rapid fire.
No, I love that. That was such a substantive answer that's going to be helpful to a lot of people. So we haven't talked much about it, but you have a young softball superstar
yep.
in your family.
Yep.
And you are a very proud softball dad.
I am. It's like just, yes, I'm very proud. I'm not going to say what I was just saying, but I'm all in.
And it's not,
I love it.
And we're not talking like, oh, I go to the games and I cheer for my daughter. You're working with her
yep.
all the time. You're helping her. There's such a, you've explained this process. It's such an intense competitive, like any Division I athlete sort of process you have to go through to get recruited.
Yeah, it's way different than just like playing your horn and going to show up audition day. I mean, the whole recruiting process is completely different. And when you can talk to them and when you can't talk to them and who you can talk to and how you talk to them and correspond. And then it's like September 1st of their junior year, then all bets are off and then the phone starts ringing or whatever. And you go to all these tournaments with your travel ball team where they're called exposure tournaments. And all of the college coaches go to watch these games. And then you find out which college coaches are going to be at the game. And then you, on your Twitter feed, you tag all these coaches and you email the coaches, here's my schedule. I'm playing field 6 and blah. It's this whole thing. And you just hope that they, and as a pitcher, you hope they come and watch you when you're in the game. you're not bench or playing your secondary position or whatever.
What's the best part about being a softball dad?
The time I get to spend with her. It's unbelievable. We have, I think, and I don't know if she'd say this or not, but the hour it takes us to drive to her lesson and the hour it takes us to get home after her lesson is like my favorite part of the week. You know, because, and she, you know, she's maturing and she's 15 and has got like real things to talk about. You know, it's like you have this real connection, this real relationship with her. It's just awesome. You know,
so she has like lessons, like
yeah,
pitching,
every week
pitching coach.
Every week we go wow. we go see a specialist in just a little bit south of Birmingham.
Wow.
And you have to bring a catcher with you, and so I'm the designated catcher. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting
on your bucket.
On the bucket sideways.
Protect the chops.
Protect I'm the only dad in there wearing a face mask. And of course people ask me, why do you like, you know, what's up? And it's like, it's for my job. I'm a lip model. Like I can't take a. And the other thing is that there's nothing soft about softball. Those right. things hurt. And when they're coming at you 56, 57, right. 58 miles an hour and you miss and it hits your ankle, it's not fun.
My what I would say is, well, I mean, I'm a trombonist and I have a very strong arm. Sure. I'm just protecting the softball.
It's like you should, yeah. You'd put a big ring of confidence in the side of a softball. But no, it's I am all in. I just love it. And I love how into it she is. And I mean, you heard us. We were in the truck after, you know, called home to sort of talk to everybody. And I was like, put her on the phone. How'd you pitch? How was your curveball today? Who got a hit? And blah, 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 you know.
And she spoke to us in a British accent.
Yeah, she's like, yeah, she would never do that if you were face-to-face. She's so embarrassed, but it's pretty cute the way she can kind of carry on. So,
man. Okay, that's awesome. So, yeah, photography and softball dad,
yep.
That's a great balance.
Yeah.
Since you're a Tim Ferriss fan as well,
yeah.
and you called me out for my Tim Ferriss question I stole, I'm going to ask you it.
Okay.
If there was a billboard that the entire world could see and you could write anything on it, mm-hmm. what would it say?
Trust the process. I stole that from my colleague, Nick Saban. You know, we're employed at the same institution.
Oh, did he coach here?
Have you heard of him?
He does the sports.
He's the sports ball.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Trust the process. And I have this whole clinic that I do at universities, and I did it at the Midwest Clinic a few years ago about the correlations between, you know, coaching and what we do as musicians, and basically take two or three of his famous speeches that people have watched on YouTube and took point by point by point and poured it to specific music things and down to the, well, this is, he's talking about this, these are your long tones and this is playing your drums and this is rhythm work. And it's like, you know, and it's so easy to draw inspiration from somebody that is such a great communicator as he is and teacher. And so
you should have gotten that thing with your studio where you could just touch that button and the door opens.
Yeah.
You seen that documentary?
I need to do that.
That's,
I'll work on that.
Then you never have to stand up.
I just make them open the door.
Yeah. I imagine you've had conversations with him.
No, I've photographed him a bunch and he comes to band rehearsal every camp and talks to the band, and so he's there, and I'm always taking pictures, but it's always made very clear that when he's around, it's not a photo op. He's there, and then he leaves. Like he's polite and stuff, but he's coming straight from practice, and he does a thing, and then that afternoon we take the leadership and the seniors of the band over to football practice and get to watch football practice and then teach the freshmen the fight song. So if you ever watch those clips on ESPN, there's a chance that you can see me in the back, like sniping with my camera, right? But we did have an interaction one of my first years. I was driving from where I took my son to daycare and passing the football complex to go to the music school. And I look up and here he comes and he's in the turning lane. And I'm like, oh my God, there's Nick Saban. I got to play it cool. So I just sort of put my hand up on the steering wheel and I sort of gave it one of those attaboys, raise a hand. And he gave me one.
Yeah, he did.
So I'm like, we're boys.
Boom.
We're boys.
So basically, you talk about him, but you don't talk to him, and you've taken a lot of photos of him.
Yeah.
So basically,
we're pretty much besties.
Yeah. You're the equivalent of a stalker. I mean, by all definitions.
One of millions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Well, man, I have been talking to you all day.
Yeah. Sorry.
And it's been such a pleasure. And, I'm exhausted, but you've just made this whole process so wonderful.
Well, I appreciate it.
And I'm glad that, because we've been talking, but
corresponding on and off and Facebook thing or Instagram things and text stuff. And then when we started to sort of plan this visit. I just wish Nick were here, actually.
It's all right.
Does anybody ever say that?
Fine. No.
Okay.
No, he's he's fine. He's just an AI that I put in to like make fart jokes every 5 minutes when there's a lag.
Yeah. Well, next time we hang, we'll have to make sure we have the whole crew together so we can get the full retreat experience.
Well, for sure. And he will be listening to this and we'll be talking about it. And I think I'm also nervous, you two in the same room. I mean,
is that going to be bad?
Yeah. I mean, who knows what'll happen there?
Well, maybe we shouldn't turn the microphone on for that, for that one.
But man, it's just been really nice getting to know you.
Yes.
I've had such respect for you from afar long, and just getting to watch how you work, and even in a small dose and the way you've treated me, it's been just a really beautiful little trip, and I feel honored to be here. I feel like we might be friends now.
Yeah, I think we're in the club. I think we're going to have to sort of keep this thing rolling. So we'll do it again.
So we'll text at like 3 a.m. every night.
Well, maybe tomorrow, since we got to go to the airport.
My God. We can call each other and look at the moon at the same time.
Yeah, I felt bad. Actually, I called you the other day about some details of your trip, and you were just waking up. I was like, this is a terrible way to wake up.
Helps. I needed to get out of bed. No, well, this has been awesome. In closing, is there anything that we didn't mention that you'd like to say?
Huh. I don't know. I think a career in music is worth the effort, I think. I mean, it really is rewarding when you find the where you want to be in the profession, whether it's, playing the pit in an opera or playing in a major symphony or teaching, or even teaching middle school band. I mean, I have the most respect. The middle school band directors are probably the most important people on the planet. So getting foundation, getting people started and interested in music and that's why I really I have a pretty open mind about, talking to marching bands or going and talking to middle school bands. I mean, it's just all, that's what they enjoy, and I just think it's really worth the trouble, because I have this saying, and that I've talked about with friends and family all the time. It's like being a musician, you have one more very time consuming and incredibly important thing to do every day than sort of the normal person, and that's practicing, and a lot of it regularly in a room by yourself for hours on end, and it's not always pretty, and it's not always fun, and it's easy to sort of just talk down on yourself and sort of beat yourself up. But it's, in the end, it's like we get to do this, we get to talk about the instrument and the repertoire that we love. The best part about it is the hang. I mean, it's absolutely the most important and best part is the after concert hang, or the funny stuff that happens in a rehearsal, or the, you know, and it's just totally worth it. So I would assume a lot of your listeners are college aged or whatever, and maybe some of them are in the middle of a degree and they're just like, it's like stick
it's
it
just,
out.
It's just my mom that listens
just
to
your
this.
Mom.
I hate to burst your bubble.
Wow. But it's just, it's so worth it, you know, and it, you know, it's totally worth chasing, you know, so maybe so, that, maybe that's all.
That's great. Mr. Jonathan Whitaker, your story has been amazing so far, and it continues to be written, and I couldn't be more excited for you in this new chapter. And
yeah,
I think
same.
Once you get there, you're going to thrive, and I can't wait to come see you there, and I'm just so excited for you. And this has been really cool, and we did it.
We made it, and you're still awake?
We're still awake. Let's just stay up. Let's just stay up.
I'm going to let you stay up. I'm going to go home. I live not far from here. I'm going to go lay down. Look.
Very cool. Well, yeah, we'll get some sleep, and yeah, this has been awesome.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks, man.
Hey, man.
Oh, no, it didn't record any of it.
Sebastian.
Yes, sir.
I have one word for John Whitaker.
What's that?
Perseverance.
Ooh.
And let me explain myself. You know, he...
Please do.
He went to school, and then he went to more school, and then went to more school, and then he decided, all right, I'm going to become... was a middle school band director, and then decided, this isn't the path for me. And then decided, I'm going to go out there and try to be a trombone player, and then decided, this isn't the path for me either. And got a job teaching, you know, and then kept rising through the ranks, and like he continues to do so, which it's hard to keep succeeding as you get older. Doesn't matter how old you are, how young you are. It's like it's hard to keep up that drive to keep succeeding. And I found that to be kind of my main takeaway from his whole story.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost things we don't say out loud sometimes, but making such a move like that, you know, it's usually people with big job changes. You're, you know, maybe in your 20s, 30s, maybe your 40s, but like that's a big move. And he had been there a long time, and I'm sure a lot of people thought he'd be there forever. And it wasn't public when we recorded that, it wasn't public knowledge yet. So like I couldn't release it right away. But it meant a lot to him, and you could tell he really thought about it. And I mean, he's one of those people that you can just tell is going to thrive wherever he goes, because he's been successful wherever he's gone. And you just see the way his students look at him. And I mean, he's a fantastic trombonist, too. I got to hear him play, and fantastic teacher. And yeah, I'm just really excited to see. And it's like, I mean, it's like a new friend, like, because I didn't know him that well when I went down there, and we just kind of hit it off. Now we're texting all the time. And I think I've just replaced you with him, you know, as like the first guy I text.
Little Southern drawl in the hang. No, I'm really happy for him. I mean, you know, like starting a new chapter, especially when you have a family and you've been used to a whole situation for, was it 15 years he was there?
You listened to it more recently than I did. So I was, I was like half awake.
Right.
I think he said
15 years he was at Alabama. Wow. And, you know, that's a long time to be in one place and then to uproot. I mean, it's really difficult. So just that alone, just the uprooting part of it, not to mention a whole change of scenery, getting a new house, like finding your new grocery store, all this stuff is just like things you don't think about when you're like young and trying to get a job. And it doesn't matter what that job is. You don't think about the logistics, but like when you get older, it's like you kind of get roots set in the ground, and it's hard to change habits. And, you know, it's while a lot of it's the same. I mean, he's going from being a trombone professor to being a trombone professor. He's changing environments in a complete way. You know, everything's going to change. So, you know, I'm really happy for him, and, you know, he deserves the best. He's a really good guy. And, anyone who's studied with him just has nothing but the greatest things to say. And that says a lot, because, you know, it doesn't have to be that way, but people wax poetic about him.
You know, life's a lot about at least professionally navigating that fine line, right, between finding that dream thing that you just love doing every day and getting that stability that you want. And hopefully you, if you can find that sweet spot where you kind of get both, which is, right. It's a pretty rare thing. And, you know, sometimes on that path to pursuing that thing you really, really, really love, you get tempted by that really comfortable thing or that thing that maybe provides opportunities for new goals you have in life or raising a family or whatever. Like, I don't know. It's that's kind of the fun of it. And so, you know, especially when you get really locked into something, it's pretty rare to step out from it. And it's also kind of scary.
Of course it's scary, like change up your whole scene, you know, no matter which way you're going. Like, I mean, obviously a lot of his change is within the same boundaries of what he's been doing, but it's a change nonetheless. And there's going to be growing pains is not quite the right word, but it's in the right realm of what I'm thinking about adapting pains, I suppose. But that goes with any change in your life. And I'm impressed that he's willing and able to do so far enough in his career that where most people would not be willing to uproot like that. It's hard.
With your voice like it is right now, dealing with the cold, could you go to a children's bookstore and just buy about 20 classic books of literature and just record some bedtime stories? Because, man, I would just love to listen to that Nick Schwartz narration as I fall asleep.
I think I would run out of voice about 10 pages into a book. I'm right on the edge of losing my voice right now. I've been trying not to speak much.
Sorry. And I'm like, please tell me everything you think. Have you seen those sleep story things where like Matthew McConaughey reads you a book and it's like an overly detailed book and you just kind of like can't keep track of it or whatever?
I haven't seen that one. I've seen the Samuel L. Jackson doing the go the bleep to sleep. I won't say it.
Is that that works? Wow.
Go the to sleep.
Oh, yeah, because we don't cuss on this, do we?
Well, I feel like this one's been pretty PG, so I'll keep it away.
Oh, wow. Yeah, we're ushering in our new audience, our new young audience.
Mm-hmm.
Family-friendly Trombone Retreat podcast fun. No more talk about light beers.
Just gather around the radio with your cups of hot cocoa and listen to us talk about the slide trombonemophone.
You know, we don't talk about the slide trombone that much, do we?
I mean, it's kind of implied.
It's like stories told through trombonists' eyes. But, you know, besides me talking about my mouthpiece every 5 minutes, I mean, we're pretty much... we're telling life stories, which is pretty cool because I have some very loyal friends and loyal listeners that do not know anything about the trombone and really like listening, or they know a lot about it now. But cool, man. Well, I hope you start feeling better.
This has been relentless. I've been sick and with allergies since Saturday, and today is Wednesday. So I'm just sick and tired of being sick and tired. Let's put it that way. It could be worse. I could play the viola.
Wow. Just brought it back. Brought it back to me.
Well, you know, I'll keep it on brand for us. I'll keep it on brand. It could be worse. I could play the euphonium.
You know, one thing I could talk about, speaking of which, and terrible transition, but I actually got to go to Lance LeDuc's memorial service. Mm. And I, first of all, absolutely beautiful service, as you would imagine. Matthew Murchison played, who's one of my favorite euphonium players on the planet, one of my favorite musicians on the planet. The Pittsburgh Symphony brass played, which was gorgeous. Some of his ensembles from Carnegie Mellon played some of his music, and there's a lot of great speeches. And, you know, in true Lance fashion, you know, first of all, it was packed, this giant church just packed, which was no surprise of how many people love him and how many people traveled to see him. And there's a lot of laughter, a lot of tears, and it really hit you. And I think Lance would be okay with me observing this. I don't think I've ever been in a room with so many euphonium and tuba players in my life.
On a scale,
it was a spectacle.
On a scale from one to Axe body spray, intensity, how bad was the smell?
Oh my God. You should have said on a scale of one to pantomime, because that's like the solo they always play.
Oh, I don't even know that. Why would I pay attention to that?
You know, I don't think they get out much, so the smell is okay. You know, they weren't working up too much of a sweat because they're not. It's not like they're working. You know what I mean?
You got them.
No, it was some of the really sweet people. Got to meet a lot of nice people. David Cutler, who's actually wrote that book, The Savvy Musician, the book I'm actually teaching out of at my music entrepreneurship class at Cleveland Institute of Music. He was there, and so I got to meet him and tell him how I'm teaching out his book, which was really cool. And he actually performed and was absolutely beautiful.
Wow.
I think it was a Tom Waits song. It was incredible. Yeah, I mean, it was just filled with music, and his daughter spoke, and it just destroyed everyone. Just such a beautiful, beautiful speech about, like, you guys all might know my father as Lance LeDuc, you know, the teacher, the mentor, the friend. And I just want to talk about what Lance LeDuc was like as a father. And it was just a really beautiful, beautiful day that, you know, we need these moments to kind of snap us back into reality and stop looking at our phones and be grateful. So
totally.
Grateful for him and grateful for the people I've met through him and grateful for all the times he's spent at the trombone retreat and inspiring our students. And all we can do is work hard to carry on the legacy of what he would teach and what we'd do. And I think about him every day. I'm teaching at Cleveland Institute, which is, I'm teaching the same type of class that he was teaching at Carnegie Mellon. And so I can only hope to aspire to do any modicum of what he was able to do. So anyways, so that was my downer, but we made fun of euphonium, so it kind of worked.
We got a couple jabs in there. That's all that matters.
We should, if you're a euphonium player that actually knows we're kidding and listens to all of our episodes, please send us a message, because we'd love to talk to you.
Yeah, we understand euphonium as well, you know, the grunts and groans. And
I can play a B-flat scale.
Yeah.
If you enjoyed the podcast, please consider leaving us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Follow us at Trombone Retreat on the Facegrams, Insta-tweets, and U-books, as well as our website, tromboneretreat.com, where you can join our mailing list. Also, feel free to shoot us an email at tromboneretreat@gmail.com, as we love hearing from you, unless you are a Kenyan prince trying to wire us $8 million. On Instagram, follow Nick at basstrombone444 and myself at js.vera on the Instagrams.
And as always, if you're trying to fry up some eggs and some lard and margarine.
When you combine lard and margarine, can you call it
largerine?
Largerine.
Largerine. When you're frying up some eggs and some largerine,
make sure to spread it evenly.
Give it a flip to doodle about 2 minutes in.
And serve to taste.
Retreat yourself.
That got like too literal of a actual recipe.
Well, largerine.
A metaphor.
I don't think largerine's going to take off at any point in time.
I'm going to make a t-shirt for you that says largerine and in chargerine.
Oh, I would wear that shirt.
I know you would. With like a stick figure drawing of butter with a face and like arms and legs.
Mm-hmm. Maybe with like a pigtail to let you know it's lard.
But he's like in charge, so he's got like a whistle.
Or maybe a
people
staff.
People that have a whistle.
A staff, maybe.
Oh, it's like, so he's like, he's Moses, like he's a holy margarine.
Or like a drum major.
Retrieve yourself.
Retrieve yourself.